welcome to the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Joe. Hi, hello. Before we get into today's episode, just wanted to ask for you to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you do your listening. Those reviews really help share our podcast with more people who might be interested in listening, just like you. You can follow us on social media. We're at Pro Book Nerds on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And you can reach out to us nerds via email as well. That email is professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. Thank you so much for coming here today, and thank you to our libraries who give us amazing books to read. With that, let's get into today's episode. My guest today is a fellow Ohioan who has library love in his heart. He worked at one of the largest libraries in the United States here in Cleveland. He has spent the last decade on the local panel of the International Dublin Literary Award and here to talk about his debut novel, A Short Walk Through a Wide World, out April 2nd. It's Doug Westerbeek. Doug, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is a pleasure.
It's so funny. We were talking about this before we started. We could basically be in the same room today, and yet here we are. Zoom again. It's rare that I get to talk to someone basically in my own backyard.
Yeah, I know. Like I was just saying, I should just come over to your house and stay.
Right? You know, why not? Now, to get us started, because at this point, your book has just come out for when the listeners are hearing this. Could you tell them a little bit about A Short Walk Through a Wide World?
Sure. I'll give you my elevator pitch. Well, maybe a little longer than that, but I'll give you a little elevator type pitch. So it starts off, you meet Aubrey Torvelle. She's this 8-year-old girl living in 1880s Paris. And she's sitting around the dinner table one day and she gets really sick. And her family all, you know, they all freak out. They take her to the hospital as quick as they can. And when she gets to the hospital, she's fine. And the doctor's like, I don't see anything wrong with her. So they don't know what to do. They take her back home. As soon as they get back home, she gets sick again. And then they rush her to the hospital. And now she's even sicker. And it's getting worse and worse. And they try everything they can. They're poking her and prodding her. And she can't take it anymore. And she runs off into Paris at night. And she feels better. And she realizes it's this act of exploration, this going somewhere she's never been, that cures her. And so from right there and then, she spends the rest of her life wandering around the world, constantly on the run from her disease. And so it's, she does all these, it's an adventure. It's an epic adventure. She like climbs the Himalayas and crosses the Sahara, rafts down the Amazon, all this kind of stuff. But the flip side is, and that's why I would read it, right? But the flip side is that, you know, she has no family anymore. She's got no love life because she can never stay in one place long enough. She lives her life in a permanent exile. And so, you know, the big question is, how do you find meaning in a life that feels like a lifelong punishment?
Right. I mean, there's so many good questions that come out of it of like, how do you find peace? How can you have a nomadic life to keep yourself alive, but also have meaningful connections and things that are important to you?
It was really kind of fun writing it because the book is basically about travel, right? You're just constantly traveling. And I love to travel, and everyone you know loves to travel, right? We all love travel. And we romantic, and it's fun because it's short. You go for like a week, maybe two. And then you come home and you're exhausted and all that, but it was fun and you remember it. And we all kind of romanticize the places we go. And even if it was a bad trip, we come back and we say wonderful things because we want to enjoy our vacations. But I remember my dad had to travel for business and now he hates travel. He never wants to go anywhere again. And my wife, she's the same way. So there's like, you know, there's a flip side. I remember when I went to China with my kids, I took them. We had, I think it was like 3-4 weeks, and we went everywhere. We saw all the major cities, went all the way up to Beijing. By the time we got to Beijing, we're like, screw it. We're just sleeping for the next 3 days. No Forbidden City, no Great Wall. We were so wiped out. And so that's what happened. So imagine you have to do this the rest of your life. And so I got this book. You got a foot in each place. You got a foot in the adventure part of it. And you got a foot in the like, oh God, I never want to do this anymore part of it.
Taking us around the world, going to all of these different kind of milestone locations, what made you want to start in Paris? What made that the the first dot on the map.
And part of it was because this actually all started as a short story, right? And it was about an old lady, actually, who goes to her doctor because she has some mild ailment. She's got, like, I don't know, arthritis or something like that. And so the doctor says, why don't you travel somewhere warm and dry? Because that's what they did back then, right? 1880s. I remember the stories of, like, Chopin. He went all the way to, the composer went all the way to Majorca and for his tuberculosis or whatever. But all she heard was travel. And so she takes her doctor's advice way too seriously, goes everywhere, gets in all kinds of trouble, this little paranoid old lady. And it was kind of a comedy. But the more I thought about it, the more it developed into this other thing. So anyway, I've got Paris stuck in my head because of that, probably maybe because of Chopin, I don't know. But it also makes sense because in the 1880s, I mean, Europe was the center of the world, really, right? And you could start off, you know, I could have started off in like Moscow or Beijing or something like that. But the thing with like Russia is that you have to travel around. You can travel around Russia for years before you ever meet anybody who speaks another language or something. But in Paris, you can start there. And you're going to run out of room in France soon enough. And then you're going to be in Italy. And then you're going to be in Slovakia. You're going to meet other cultures. You're going to be lost really quickly. You've got the center of the world right there. So it's like, you know, either London or Paris, you know, someplace like that would make the sense for a starting point. And from there, she goes on to all these more remote exotic locations. And it would happen really quickly because Europe is, you know, it's a bunch of little countries all jam packed together.
Thinking of it that way makes perfect sense. And now this is where I have to flip to kind of the magic of the story. Aubrey's mysterious condition starts her on her walk, as I think of it, you know, around the world. Knowing that we're bending reality here, how did you decide on your own terms for the world? How did you kind of create this?
The more obvious way, I guess, to think about it was I was actually just really trying to be democratic, I suppose. I wanted to take her to every spot I could take her. So that's why it's structured the way it's structured. It actually starts off in Southeast Asia in the beginning there. And then we go back to tell her story. And so I'm able to jump around a lot of spots and I have these like little interruptions. The chapters are called brief asides. And I'm able to get a little hint of another adventure in each of those. And you know, just thinking of her journeys here and there. So I try to fit in as much of the world as I could. I try to do a huge variety and all that. And then the other part was, I don't know how much I should talk about it because it's kind of a spoiler. There are these libraries that she keeps running into and they're in these really unexpected places. And those were really fun to write. And the same thing, and I wanted them to reflect where she was in the world at any given place. So, you know, some of them are like really cold and frozen and some of them are like, you know, they look like the culture that she's in. Like there's looks like the ruins of Pompeii and all that sort of stuff. Those were fun to write too. Those were just kind of like imagination just gone wild. And I was able to improvise through those. But yeah, that's basically how I was coming up with the locations.
When I think of the cause of the journey, why pick the threat of death as what was moving her forward?
Well, you know, I always found that death is a really good motivator.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Nothing gets you out of bed better than the threat of death. But actually, like in a more... I guess I'd say like almost every story I've ever read, I think most stories, it's all about somebody who's living a very comfortable life, who is all of a sudden kicked out of it. And now they're in the chaos of the world and they've got to make sense of it, survive it somehow, that kind of thing. So, you know, you got to use examples everybody knows. You got Odysseus, who's perfectly happy with his wife and kid. Now all of a sudden he's dragged off to war and this. And you got Luke Skywalker, who's, you know, he's living on his farm and his family gets killed. And now he's got this droid or whatever it is, and he has to go fight the Empire. So, I mean, you're perfectly happy and then you get kicked out. And it usually takes something really serious to kick you out. And in this case, I had to keep kicking her out without her ever saying, if it was a tummy ache, it wouldn't have done it, you know. But to keep someone moving like that, it has to be serious. Because at some point she'll say, I'll just live with a tummy ache, you know, but you can't live with death. You just got to keep going.
Yeah, you can't live with, you know, kind of bleeding out of everywhere every 4 days. You kind of have to keep moving if that's what fixes it. How did it feel to write someone's whole life, essentially? I mean, we start with Aubrey when she's 8 if I remember correctly. I mean, she's very young. Right. And then by the end of the book, again, no spoilers, but by the end of the book, she's lived this very full life.
Right, right. So it's actually that made it really, well, okay, I'll put it this way. I was once asked, like, what were the easiest and the hardest characters to write? And the hardest characters were the supporting cast, so to speak, the characters who come in, like one of them is Uzair. He meets him in North Africa. He was really tricky to write because you have to he's the guy trying to help her out and all that sort of stuff. But you have to show him as being both arrogant and lonely at the same time. You have to have this kind of illicit love affair that they have. You've got to go through the whole curing and the travels across North Africa, all this in a relatively short period of time. So it was hard to like get something. And it went for all the characters, Luzair and the prince and Marta. You kind of had to capture them all in a very short period of time. Whereas I had a whole life to capture Aubrey all the way from what, age 9 to, you know, when she's way older. And so it was kind of, I'm not going to say easy because it wasn't that, but it was intuitive because, you know, I remember what I was like as a kid. I was like a spoiled, stubborn kid and all that. And I remember being a sullen teen at times. And I remember what my mom was like when, you know, when she's more of a fun-loving adult. And I remember what my grandmother was like when she was like, you know, this, you know, kind of timid, almost hermit. You know, she was got scared of the world. And that happens to older people. But I could remember all this. And plus friends of mine, I've had friends who danced on tabletops like Aubrey does in one sequence. So, I mean, I was able to like, it was a lot more natural. A lot, if you get that kind of a lifespan and go through so many shifts, so you're never quite, because you're not the same person as you were when you were a kid, and we won't be the same when we're older either. So you're writing the same character, but really different versions of them throughout their life. So it was fun because it kept me on my toes. It wasn't static. It was moving.
That's such a good way to think about it, that the walk-on roles are the harder ones to write. You only get them for a moment.
And they're really important, so you have to nail them.
Right. It's what shows that she can still have friendships, relationships, that there is more happening in her life, even though she's always uprooting and going. How long did you work on this book?
It's hard to say because, you know, it started as a short story. Well, I mean, so all my stories, when I think of them, they start off some vague idea and I just kick them around the back of my head forever until I ever write anything down. But then when you finally start writing it down, it actually kind of happens fast. With like, I'm working on the book now and I'm zooming through it. I started in January, I'm like halfway through. So I think this story probably was similar to that, but the difference is I was working a day job. I had two little kids running around my legs. I got, you know, this and that. So it was a lot harder. You had to work on it in fits and starts. I suppose if you added them all together, and this is a total wild guess, a year or two, something like that.
It's always nice to hear how everyone works. When did you find yourself getting into writing for the very first time? Have you always been writing?
Yeah, I was a little kid. I was like in third grade. I can remember like writing little short stories with a group of friends of mine. They were like goofy little stories about like little animal characters going around robbing banks and stuff like that. And I just did it to make all my classmates laugh. And years later, all my friends gave up, but I was still writing these things because I was just having a fun time. I wrote so, and I was an artist too, so I drew all the time. That I'm arthritic in this hand now, my thumb is totally always in pain now because I just developed arthritis because I wrote so much. Thank God we got like keyboards now. I'd be lost. I wouldn't know what to do.
It's slightly different pain, but but at least you can still get the writing in.
Yeah, I'll have carpal tunnel in like a couple of months.
What challenges have you struck when writing, either this book or just in general?
The biggest challenge, they're all different. Some of them are like write themselves. They're actually a joy and they're a breeze. This one was actually really tough. This is one of the hardest books I ever wrote. And the reasons are like, there are many of them. They're the structure for starters, because I knew right away I didn't want to do a linear narrative because it would have gotten tedious and I would not have been able to fit all the things I wanted to fit. I had all these ideas for it and I wanted to like see how many as I cram in as many as I could. So breaking it up making it kind of a more fractured narrative, making it so it's easy to follow and fractured at the same time, being able to fit in all the thoughts I had was tricky. And so that took a lot of passes to get that right. Also, the ending was hard to land. I knew I wanted it to be a very poetic ending. I wanted people to see the beauty and the poetry in her life. And, but you know, when we were going through it, it wasn't quite enough. We needed something a little more solid to land on. So I had to work on that. It was the first time I'd written like a rough draft without 100% knowing how I was going to end it. Like I'm a total outliner. I detail it. The way I write is that I'll have like a one page outline, right? And then I'll span it to a 20 page and then 100 page and then a 200 page. And then I'm at the rough draft and then I'm rewriting it. And it just, I'm like layering it constantly. And it just kind of expands on its own type of thing. That's how it usually happens for me anyway. And, but with this one, I really wasn't sure exactly how it was going to end. So I improvised some of it. And I'm never doing that again because that means a lot of rewrites later on. And it's much harder to rewrite after you've got something big as opposed to something small. Much easier to rewrite an outline than it is a full novel.
When you've worked out kind of all the layers and you've built onto, I mean, you're stacking against the foundation to try to rewrite that later. Sounds like it'd be tough.
Yeah.
I want to go back to adventure for a second. How have adventure stories played a part in your own life? Because looking at this and hearing how you were writing stories for your friends to make them laugh, it seems like there has always been a source of adventure for you.
Oh, yeah. Because I grew up like everybody else. You know, I grew up watching, Mad Max and Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. And I loved it. It was great. That's how me and my friends would all go to the movies together as soon as we could. Every weekend we were going out and we would watch like three movies in a day and stuff like that. So that's like my root right there, right? That's what you grow up. And then, but later on, especially when I started working at the library, you're just reading. I'm discovering all this other stuff. I'm loving Dostoevsky all of a sudden and the Bridge of St. Louis Ray and all this stuff. And now, so now my taste is a lot more sophisticated, right? And what I really like about magical realism actually is that it kind of has a foot in both places. It has the imagination and the excitement of the stuff you watched as a kid, but it's got the sensibilities of the stuff that you like now as an adult. And that's what really drew it to me. And so when I'm writing this, I mean, I've got a lot of adult influences in here. There's Somerset Maugham, there's Viktor Frankl, there's Dante's Paradiso. I remember reading that in the Bhagavad Gita. Getting that all, that was a huge inspiration to write the novel. But there's just as much Indiana Jones in this as anything else. So hopefully I hit that sweet spot between substance and entertainment, I guess. Like The Master and Margarita, when I first read that, and I remember reading it thinking, they've got like the best scene ever when they have the black hat and the killer clown and they're having the gunfight with the KGB. And I'm like, this is like high literature. I was like, you can do this? This is awesome. I was loving that. It's a favorite book of mine. And it changed how I look at literature.
What was your favorite setting to create? Taking us everywhere. And I know you talked about it a little bit with how fun all of the different libraries, and that's what inspired this question for me, is the underground library and so many of the different kind of places that represent where Aubrey travels. But what was your favorite place to create?
I think, I had fun doing each of them, but I mean, if you're gonna, so one of them is the end and I don't want to give it away.
Right. Okay, fair. We'll hold that one.
And maybe another one would be, I really had a lot of fun both researching and writing about the Tibetan nomads when she meets Pathik, because Pathik doesn't speak her language, she doesn't speak his. It's almost like a Tarzan Jane kind of moment there, and I really loved writing that. Trying to see if I can put this right. I guess I just had fun, and I had a lot of fun researching it. So I knew nothing about Tibetan nomads, so I had to I was watching documentaries and reading articles and all that sort of stuff. And it becomes like a rabbit hole because it's so interesting. You spend like weeks and weeks reading stuff that has nothing to do with your book anymore. And so you can really over research. It's kind of like, you know, you got to watch it, but it was fun at the same time. It's not like I wasted my time. I really enjoyed, you know, reading about all this sort of stuff. There was another book too, I found on colonial India with a guy who worked at the palace. I can't remember what his actual job, but he took pictures and wrote little anecdotal stories, all these old black and white photos. And it's very different. Like how you would have actually imagined, we're used to Kipling's versions, and now you were seeing modern Indian cinema and they've got their version. And it's not like either of them, the actual reality. When I saw that book, it was really, really interesting. So the research was fun, and that made all the settings I went to a lot of fun. I think the Tibetan nomads I liked the most because I learned them the most. There's a great detail in the Tibetan nomads. What is it? Because when they live on everything's like animal. So all their clothes, their tents are just woven yak fur. And then they don't have any trees out there, so they burn the yak dung, and the yak are out there eating garlic. And so that at night, the tents are filled with this kind of like wild garlic smell. And it was like, I read that and I was like, that's going in the book. You know, I did all that reading and that's what gets in the book.
So all of the settings were great because you got to do something you love, and that's the research component.
Yeah.
Those details are what really makes it special. I mean, you have to be able to sneak in those bits and just kind of say, like, did you know that this is true? Like, you get to, I love reading for so many reasons, but moments like that where you can learn that one extra fact that you're like, do you know they did this? And this is what it smelled like.
Exactly. It was really fun. And totally addictive. And
Aubrey isn't going about this journey alone. As we've talked, we've heard about many of her different kind of cohorts throughout the years. As her story spreads, people come and go from her life. I'd have to imagine that there's a certain challenge here for both yourself and for Aubrey to have at some points, folks joining to support and show love, and some just coming in for the spectacle of Aubrey because her story spreads. So what in life kind of motivated showing both sides of people can come to care and people can come to lurk?
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
So my original conceit actually was, and it gets overlooked because there are so many bigger elements of the book, like traveling the world, the adventures, the libraries, all that kind of stuff. But actually one of the smaller conceits that nobody's noticed yet was that I designed it so that she would like encounter different varieties of love. Like really good one. So like Uzair in the beginning was a very possessive kind of love. And then Lionel on the train is a very romantic kind of love. And you've got a platonic love later on. You've got an unrequited love. You've got love in old age. You've got Oh, even a love without words, like the Tarzan moment. And that was actually a very familial love too, because he's got a family and everything, and she's picturing herself as part of this family. So I was trying to, the idea was that she would meet all these people and experience all these, because I have a unique character at the same time. I've got this woman who's traveling the world. She can, the only time she ever gets to know people is like when she's stuck on a train with them for a long period of time, you know, a long train ride, or she decides to follow her and travel her. So Marta is that character. She's in it, I guess, because she's, like you were saying, people like, you know, I want to see the spectacle of her. And Marta's partly like that too, but it's also a bit of a love story because she literally fell in love with her photograph like years before. So it's both, really. So these are all the different kinds of loves. You have to like give an excuse so each of them can happen. And you can't, this is all she gets out of life, right? So nobody's going to blame her for it at all. So I'm in a unique situation where I can actually, she can go through different characters who represent a different kind of love. So that part was kind of interesting and fun to write too.
Giving her ways to experience all the types of love that I think we take for granted how long it takes us in our lives to experience each of those.
And some of us don't get all those, right? And some of us marry young or whatever, and this is it. And it's a particular kind of love, and it's perfectly valid and all that, of course. But this way, you get to do all kinds of love affairs that we all experience as teenagers, maybe in high school and college, and then we're done because we've done that. But these are her big moments, and then they come at different ages in her life too. So there's a lot of variety in there.
Right. There's a lot of variety. There's a great way to reflect on, as we age, how we identify or experience those different types as well. It goes into how Aubrey is blended so well to be both stubborn and introspective that so often I would find myself getting caught up in what she's feeling in the moment, along with still keeping a quick pace to go across someone's full life and still feel like you are moving as quickly as she needs to. How did you find that pacing in your writing impacted the storytelling?
I think that probably goes back to how I structured it, because, you know, she can be 30 years old talking about her 8-year-old self or 9-year-old, whatever it was, or it can be, you know, a much older woman talking about this or whatever it was. And the reason why it kind of moves that way is because you can take these stories and you can start a story here, but not finish it till way later in the novel or something like that. Or you can take two stories and put them side by side and contrast them, which is why I had like her on the train with Lionel. But then you contrast it with her in North Africa with Zaire, and they're two very different love affairs. And one guy is like totally like easygoing and interested, and the other guy is very possessive and been alone too long, and all of a sudden this girl walks into his life. And so you get to contrast these two, these how they both like do that. And it really makes the story move faster, is what I was trying to say. So I think that had a lot to do with the pacing and why it moved so fast. Because if you had done this in a traditional narrative story, it just would have been tedious. She shows up, she leaves, she shows up, she leaves, she shows up over and over again. But this way, when you break it up, it doesn't feel that way at all. I mean, you do get this constant sense of moving on, but it's not quite, doesn't have that tedium in it because you're doing all kinds of things with it.
It's moving on without always closing the door. You may be revisiting that later. You may be jumping around. And so you get these moments of closure without feeling like, okay, and the scene ends, and now we're starting back up somewhere else. It reads full narrative. What is something you are most excited about to have your first book out in the world?
Most excited about to have my first book out in the world? I don't know. It's all been like so much. It's really hard to say. It's fun having people say come up to me lately and say like, I didn't know you wrote a book. I just found this book of yours and all that. Because I have like, I'm the only Doug Westerbeek in the United States, so everybody knows it. Whoever sees it, that is. And I haven't really been going around like telling a lot of people, just like my family and stuff. So, because I figured people would see it. If they see it, they'll say it, you know, whatever. And that's fine. And I was like, yeah, I managed to pull that off.
Well, just wait until your library stocks boatloads of copies on the shelf. And they go, wait, is that?
Exactly. We'll see. But otherwise, actually, my life hasn't. I mean, there was the initial euphoria, like when you first hold the book and you're like flying high and you want to tell everybody. But now I'm actually at the point where like I want to be quiet and quiet about the whole thing, because now my life otherwise hasn't changed at all. I've still got my two kids, man, and everything. I still have to cook for them every night, all that kind of stuff. So
are you returning to Aubrey? Are you returning to this world? Is there an idea for book two? Or, because of course I can't ask, or is the ending a resolution?
For Aubrey, I think it was a resolution. Some people have asked me, like, if you could do a spinoff, like, how would you do it? And somebody, they mentioned the puzzle ball and who would get the puzzle ball. So maybe the girl with the mismatched eyes at the end, or, and someone said, how about some of the characters? And I was like, well, Marta's like a perfect choice. And Vicente at the end, because he had his own adventure too. And yeah, I suppose you could write about that. And then there's the Holcomb family, because they're a husband, wife, and two kids. I'm married with two kids. So it'd be like, I could totally relate to them having an adventure of some kind. But I haven't actually planned anything like that. These are all hypothetical. I'm up here with story ideas. So I'm like, a back one to catch up on. I just thought the answer to your, what are you most excited about? And I think it's the fact that I'm able to sit around and really spend like all day writing, which is what I've been doing now. And that's the exciting part. I get to write and write and write, and I don't have to put it aside to shelf books or whatever I was doing at the library. And or before that, I was a paralegal. And before that, I was a cook. And before that, I was something else. I always had a day job and would write whenever I could. And now I could just write, and that's by far the best part of the job. Easy. It's what I've always wanted to do.
I knew you'd get there. I knew the answer was there somewhere.
That's the answer. I'm gonna have to remember this next time someone asks.
The next time someone asks you, you are excited to get to write. I mean, and yet how, so does it feel good to just know that that's what you get to do now? Kind of what you all maybe always wanted to be doing is sit and write, and now you're getting to sit and write.
It's totally what I've always wanted to be doing. I love telling stories. I've got like I said a backlog of them, so I don't think I'll be able to live long enough to write them all.
That's the curse of people who love books. Whether you're writing or reading, there's never enough time to read every story, and there won't be enough time to write everyone.
Right. Yeah, so true.
I have to ask, this cover is beautiful. I mean, you've got foiling. You've got so many good elements here. It has it, of course, you know, audio medium, no one can see it, but no one can see what I'm holding up, but you've got different parts on the cover that signify the different places that she traveled to. What was your input like when it came to this cover? I mean, also like the front and the back having the different map and compass corners. I mean, it's so good.
That was totally, I knew nothing about covers or design. I handed it off, and that was totally Simon and Schuster. I remember Margot, my editor, was saying, you know, I picture something like kind of old fashioned Jules Verne type of thing. And I was like, which I hadn't pictured at all, actually. And I was a little skeptical, but then this came back. This is like a great cover. I love the little dotted line, because that leads way up to the sun, because it's a story, it's a spiritual journey as well as everything else. So it's, you know, it's a character study, it's an epic adventure, it's got philosophy woven within it, but it's also a very spiritual tale. It's like a pilgrim's tale almost. And you've got this, it's a story of enlightenment, and here we got this trail goes right up to the sun. I think that's brilliant. And that was, he did that in a rough draft when we really quite hadn't cemented the ending yet, so he just intuitively knew we were going there, which knocked me sideways.
When it's right, it's right. You know, yeah. when they come back the first time and you go, well, that's the cover.
Yeah, totally.
On the other end of things, Saskia Marleveld is going to be doing the audiobook for A Short Walk.
I can't wait.
Did you get any samples? What was your audiobook process like? Were you involved?
I had no idea what to expect, because I'm a huge audio. I would say 90% of the stuff I read, I actually listen to, I used to commute, and I still drive around a lot. And when you have two little kids running around, you don't have time to sit down and open up a book and read for a couple hours. That's not going to happen. And so, I mean, You gotta grab in most. You gotta grab the time when you can, and it's mostly through listening, like while you're doing the dishes or mowing the lawn or whatever it is, or hiking through the woods, because I have to get some kind of exercise. The bad thing about writing is that it's a very sedentary process. I was approached by the audiobook people, and they're like, "Well, here's some names. I don't know who you know," and they just gave me a bunch of names, and I was like going through, and then some of them, they were all great candidates and stuff like that. But I remember there was this one woman I remember hearing, and I went looking through Audible, and I did, they give you that little place where you sample. And then I found her voice because I remember hearing her before, and I was like, and so I emailed him back. It's like, oh, these are great. I like so-and-so and so-and-so, but have you considered Saskia? I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right, but they said, oh yeah, she'd be a great choice. And that's who we ended up getting. So it was great. Other than that, the only interaction we've had is like when they have trouble pronouncing names or something like that. But remember, like in that part in the Tibetan Plateau, they're speaking, I think it's Nepalese, if I remember right, or Nepali, maybe it's called Nepali. No, I think it's Nepalese. Anyway, and that's all written in the actual language. I have no idea how she's going to pull that off.
I mean, I'm definitely looking for, because there are so many moments in here when you do incorporate another language into the text. How is she going to do that? I can't wait. I mean, this is a story that to me, you're immediately ready to experience it again, at least at some point. So when that audiobook hits, I am diving back
in. Oh, I can't wait for the audiobook. I'm dying to hear it. There's bits of room. My favorite translation story is she's on the train. She's talking to Lionel, and they're talking about the different phrases they've picked up. And they're all these like dirty X-rated phrases. So I can't really repeat it here. But one of them is in Romanian, and it's like the dirtiest one of all. and I didn't know how to write it in Romanian. So I don't even think it was in Romanian, but I had a Romanian friend. So I said, okay, I'll do a Romanian version of this. And I asked her, how do you say this in Romanian? And she's like, oh my God, that's really tough to pull off. So she got together with some Romanian friends of hers, and they got together because the Romanians they've got all kinds of curse words and all that sort of stuff. And they had to pick the right one. It was epic. It took them a couple of weeks just to do that one line. It was a great story.
That's honestly one of my favorite things about where we're at today. Like this level of collaboration, getting to work with your friends and having her pull in some of her friends and kind of the community element that comes in into everything now. I mean, whether it's a video on TikTok or it's writing just a line in a book that at the end of the day is like, for you and for the people who can speak Romanian, they're like, oh, I can't believe it.
Right. Because at your first, I was doing all the translations on like, I can't remember, Google or whatever it was. And I couldn't trust them. I had no idea. And she's like, yeah, there's no way you need actual Romanians to do this because not going to be able to pull it off. So yeah, it was great. It was so good thing I knew a Romanian lady.
Right. Made it work out for you.
Yeah.
I'm excited to talk about this book, but I'm also excited to talk about the fact that you're from the library. You're from the library and you're from Ohio. Two things that I can never get enough of. Can you tell the listeners a bit about your life in the library before now that you get to be working as a writer?
Oh yeah. So I started off, I moved to Cleveland and I did all kinds of odd. So it's all my wife's fault. So she's a musician. She plays violin. And so she was playing with, I followed her to Baltimore and Philadelphia and then Boston. And then she ended up settling down with the Cleveland Orchestra. So I'm like, every time she did this, I had to pack up and start all over. So I've been everything. I've been a photographer and a cook and this and that. And I get here, I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? I ended up being a paralegal. And then somebody, and I'm like, this is not for me, but it was actually nice and all, but it wasn't for me. It was a very solitary existence. So, but somebody said, you know what? You could work at the library because that sounds like all this kind of stuff you love is all there. It's a big library. I was like, yeah, totally. And so, because I spent so much time there anyway, researching stories and everything else, I was like practically living there anyway. So I said, all right, yeah, I'll work there. And it worked out. I started as a sub. I worked in all, 28 branches of the Cleveland Public Library. And then I moved downtown in the literature department, which was the perfect department. I had so much fun there. Everybody was great. I have so many friends. The popular department, which was all periodicals, music, all the movies were there. So it was just like, it was just heaven. I loved her. And you work in there and stuff will just randomly come across your desk every day. And you're like itching to read it and you're busy. But, you know, at the end of the day, hopefully you get some time to look through it and all that sort of stuff. It was a great experience. The thing I remember the most about the library is how ignorant I was before I started working there. Because once I started working there, I learned so much about all kinds of things. I learned like how to invest in the stock market. I was doing like critical analysis of Shakespeare, and I was reading books I never would have read before. Cooking home recipes every night so I could cook for my family, hundreds of them. It was heaven.
It really is heaven. And I think we all, until we're just really embroiled in it, forget how much our library gives us access to. I think of Boston, where you can borrow passes to go to the museum, and the archives downtown, and the maker spaces. There's so much. But right, and then on the flip side, you have that magazine sitting right there, and you go, oh, well, what's in the recipe section for today? What came out this week? So I think that asks really well. When I say public library, what comes to mind?
Oh, they call it the People's University. And that, for me, it really was. It's exactly how I think of it, actually. Other things come to mind, too. All my friends are there. I remember all the patrons, because, you know, mostly they're all really nice. Some of them are crazy nice. So I always remember them. But mostly, yeah, how much I learned while I was working there. It was stunning. I mean, if you're a paralegal, you just don't get this. I learned all about being a paralegal, but I didn't learn about history and this and that. And it's just so much.
Now, before we start to wind down, is there anything you'd like listeners to take away from A Short Walk Through a Wide World that we haven't mentioned already?
Yeah, this is what I would say. So it's funny, it may be about my writing in general, but I was like, when I was like a little kid, like 6, 7 years old, I became this avowed atheist. Totally convoluted thinking. It didn't really make any sense, but I was a kid and I was stubborn, and I just went with it. And it stuck. I stuck till my adulthood. I used to have like debates with religious friends of mine and stuff like that. Very friendly debates, but still, you know, stuck to my guns. And then I kept writing all these stories. And sometime, not even that long ago, I started looking back on all my stories and I'm noticing they're all about these atheistic characters who don't believe in God or don't like God, but are beloved by him anyway. And it's a constant theme running through my stories. I'm like, it's all about people's relationship to forces that are way bigger and totally incomprehensible to them. And they're at war with these forces, even though the forces don't necessarily have it out for them or anything like that. But all my stories are about that relationship I'm starting to notice. And so I mentioned that because I think it helps with the understanding of the book in general. And at the end, you know, I want the idea is to find that beauty in poetry that is in Aubrey's life. Because if you could find it in her life, because to me, that fight, that struggle between us and the forces that are bigger than ourselves is like the most epic part of the story. And this is already a pretty epic story, right? And I think that even knocks that out of the water. So it's huge. But in the end, you know, it does mean something at the end, what she goes through. And if you can recognize the beauty in the poetry in that, then, you know, hopefully you can recognize the beauty in the poetry in your own life, theoretically.
The spiritualism throughout the book is a really good thing to kind of sit with as you read and as you enjoy, and especially when you get to the end.
Yeah, I hope so.
To wind down on an easy note, just some questions from a nosy podcaster, as if I hadn't asked quite enough already. What are you reading or listening to right now?
I've been writing like crazy, so I haven't been reading that much, and most of it's just been research stuff. I'm really looking forward to Simone Garinda is putting out her book, I think, in a week called The Wives. So I'm looking forward to that because it's a memoir, and I come from actually a fairly pretty half of my family is like in the military. And so it's all about marry this guy. And in the middle of their marriage, he just decides, you know what? I really feel I have to go off and fight in Afghanistan and help. And it comes out of the blue for her. And she's like, oh, well, how do I cope with this? And he does, he goes off, and now she's a wife sitting at home with all these other military wives. And I want to read that just because I have so much of it in my own family.
Always good to have a book that you're looking forward to. Keeps me, keeps me going. As a person who cooks, what is the item on the menu that you judge the restaurant by? If they can do this well, I'll probably have a good time, or I'll try something else here next time.
Well, I had to give up meat and chicken and pork at some point. So I'm always looking at the seafood part or the vegetarian, or at least a good salad, if nothing else. But hopefully I want more than a salad. So that's, yeah. So that's probably how I measure them.
What project that you can talk about are you working on right now?
Well, I'm halfway through this book. I finished another book right after this. Now I'm on my third.
Okay.
Now the one after that is going to be an AI story. So actually all that research I'm talking about, I'm like doing all this research on AI.
Mm-hmm.
That's been absolutely fascinating. It's really amazing to listen to, like, hear what's going on and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I got that. I've got another one planned after that. Like I was saying, I got a ton. I've got enough to take me into old age.
You're just working through the backlog.
I am. It's almost mechanical. Okay, next one. Okay, next. But they're fun. I'm loving it. So.
And where can the listeners keep up with you online?
Yeah, I'm not much of a social media guy. I got into Facebook for one week. And I was like inundated with people I've been avoiding my whole life.
That's the problem with Facebook.
Yeah. So I was like, and it's work. You have to keep it up. Actually, I don't really mind having people, but it was a lot of work keeping up your profile and emailing and messaging people back. And I just got off of it.
Yeah.
But I do have there's not much there, but I'm on Goodreads because my book, you click me and there I am.
So that's the best place to keep up with what's going on in your book life is Goodreads. Love it.
Yeah, I guess so. I'll make it a hub.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. It was fun.
And listeners, you can pick up A Short Walk Through a Wide World on April 2nd and keep up with Doug on Goodreads. Thank you all so much for joining us today and happy reading.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode on overdrive.com or in Libby. Our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Emma Dwyer and Joe Skelly and presented by Overdrive. To learn more, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Calafato, and I'm the creator of 7-Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.